Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
A lesson in survival continues. What you need to do depends on what you have to do what needs to be done. What do? If you find yourself lost with just the clothes on your back? Do you find yourself out of sync with your topo map as nightfall sets in? Are you geared up with provisions and gear? What you have to do has so many variables. Stop. Don't panic. Do the right thing. We'll be right back. We now continue with our lesson in survival with Howard Paul, president of Colorado Search and Rescue. Stick with us now, as the information you're about to hear may save your life. Well, no, this young boy was out there for 4 days. Apparently, he had wandered off on his own a little bit and got homesick. This is what I'm hearing now, and decided to hitchhike back to his town. That's what I couldn't figure out, how he's hitchhiking back to his, but not his family, but his town and his friends. Okay. And that's where he got into trouble. And then I've also just recently read that he did not follow your advice. And that is the fact that he kept wandering around. Talk about the importance of really making almost like a base camp. Isn't that really the best thing to do?
It really is. As long as someone knows where you are, you know, your general area. You've told someone where you're going. You've told someone when you're to be expected back. If you don't turn back up, someone's going to report you missing. Someone's going to be looking for you. So, again, it's important to help the searchers by remaining in either entirely stationary or in a very small area, again, so that you're not a moving target, which is hard to find, and you don't leave an area that's about to be searched and walk into an area that has already been searched. Now, again, with small kids, we talk about teaching them to hug a tree. A tree can be your friend. We, in searching for lost folks, use all sorts of different techniques. The obvious one is people on the ground, walking, listening, calling out, and looking for clues. The clues can be footprints, could be a piece of clothing. It could be a glint of color or a reflection off in the distance. These are all clues that are going to lead us to the lost person. We're actually not looking for the lost person. We're looking for the clues that lead us to the lost person.
Do you ever teach people to actually leave some sort of clue? If they now, you don't do this if you're just hiking, because then you're destroying the natural environment, which you certainly don't want to do. But if you find yourself in a situation where you feel that you're lost, what are some ways that a person can actually leave those clues? What would you advise?
Well, I've seen folks that have actually written a note and left it on a trail with their name and some sort of message. I was involved in a search many years ago where a lost gentleman who was outracing us, he was moving so fast, he took the peel from his orange that he had eaten, and with something had drawn an arrow on it on the inside of the orange and left it at a trail junction.
Great
his
idea.
Initials said, "I'm going this way."
Great idea. Yeah.
When I talk about clues, I don't mean things that you necessarily specifically leave behind, but things that you might leave behind without realizing it. You know, people do drop wrappers from candy or granola bars. That's a great clue, but it may be something that you have inadvertently left. Could be a hat, could be a glove, something that's fallen off your pack. That's why when we interview the folks that have reported you missing, we do a very exhaustive interview as to what you're carrying, what are you likely to be carrying, what colors of clothing and equipment are you carrying, so if we come across something on the trail, we can quickly determine if that likely belonged to you or not.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, as I mentioned before, in assisting us to find you, even if you're going to hug your tree, whether you're a child or an adult staying in one area, it's best if you can pick a tree or pick a spot to remain in that's near a clearing, so that if you hear an aircraft, especially the helicopter, you can go out into that clearing and you'll be much easier to see. When we teach the kids this concept, we teach them to go out into the clearing and lay down almost like they're making snow angels, because they're a bigger target to see from the air than if they were standing up and all we can see is their head and their shoulders. That gets back to making yourself big. You know, the other thing is, if you've got objects of color, and that could be, you know, almost anything. It could be a piece of paper, a piece of fabric, a wrapper from food. If you can hang those in a tree, in a circle around your general area, and within, you know, distance that you can see easily, again, those are out of the ordinary objects that are going to catch the eye of a searcher. They're not going to catch the eye of someone in a helicopter because they're too high and they're moving too fast. They're essentially looking for spots of color. But a searcher on the ground, something in a tree is extraordinarily unusual, unnatural, and that they're going to catch that in their eye and investigate it immediately.
Now, in this particular case with the boy in North Carolina, this apparently is a fairly common thing, and we'll talk a little bit about hypothermia, because that is a very serious problem. But when he was discovered, and I'd also like you to touch on the role of search and rescue dogs and how we can help them find you, you know, they were calling out and he didn't respond. Which, if for some, you know more about that than I do, but that seems to be somewhat of a common experience.
Well, that's true. There are a couple reasons that a youngster might not respond. You mentioned hypothermia for one. Hypothermia, by definition, is your body is losing heat faster than it can create heat, and that can be caused by it's either extremely cold and wet, or on the other side of that equation, your body has run out of fuel and it can no longer create heat by shivering, for example, because your reserves of sugar are so low. So it's either you have not enough fuel to warm up, or you can't make up the heat that you've already lost because of the outdoors, the surroundings around you. And cold is exacerbated. It's made so much worse by moisture. One of the worst things you can get caught in when it starts to rain are jeans or anything else that's cotton. We call it, in search and rescue for years, we've been talking about killer cotton, because when it gets wet, it just sucks the heat and energy right out of you. You cannot reproduce that heat fast enough. When the body starts to cool down, because of hypothermia, and by the way, very vigorous shivering is not necessarily a sign of extreme danger. That's your body using its fuel to try and reheat itself back up. It's a very good warning sign that you probably need some help in warming back up, but it's not a sign of terrible danger. But when the body starts to cool down, several things happen. And essentially, the problem is that the brain is not functioning as it normally would. So it will not correctly control involuntary actions and even voluntary actions. A real obvious sign is when someone starts to lose muscle coordination. And that can be something as simple as stumbling, not being able to walk as well as you normally would, maybe having difficulty in putting on mittens or gloves. You're losing that muscle coordination. The next thing is that you might start to have difficulty speaking. You might slur words. That's another sign. There are three stages of hypothermia. We're talking now about getting into that moderate stage of hypothermia that really requires help from someone else, and that is in rewarming you and keeping you warm by putting on additional clothing. Rewarming you maybe by building a fire, giving you some additional fuel that you can burn to get that furnace going again and reheat from the inside and put on some extra warm and dry clothing. This time of the year is actually sometimes even considered worse than winter time for hypothermia, and summer can be as well, and most folks might be surprised by that. There's a reason why. People are prepared generally in the wintertime for cold weather, so they take that stuff along that they need. They take that extra clothing. In the spring and in the summer, they're not thinking cold, so they're more likely to be caught without the extra clothing when the wind kicks up and the rain starts, and suddenly now they're soaking wet and they're in a 10 or 15 mile an hour breeze, and that convection cooling is just, it's sucking the heat out of you faster than you can replace it.
I'm getting uncomfortable thinking about that. I've been in those situations. And one of the things about hypothermia is the fact that it can come on so quickly that, you don't even know what's happening. It doesn't take long to get, before you find yourself chilled, you get a little wet, as you say, possibly even from just perspiration. And then a cold or a cool breeze comes in, and the next thing you know, you're starting to go into that zone. It doesn't take long to get there, does it?
No, it doesn't take long at all. And the important thing to remember is when you go from that first stage hypothermia, which you'll recognize you're cold, but you probably aren't thinking hypothermia. When you go from that first minimum stage into that moderate stage, you're now having enough, your brain has decreased in its ability enough that you will not recognize it in yourself. And that's why we always tell people when you're in a group is to keep an eye on each other, because they will recognize it in you where you won't. They'll see that you're having muscle coordination problems. You're stumbling. You're having difficulty putting on mittens. You perhaps are having difficulty getting up after taking a lunch break.
It's odd. I was out cross-country skiing with a couple of friends, a guy and his girlfriend, and we got a little out ahead of her or something to that effect, and she just seemed to disappear. And so at some point we thought, well, what's going on here? And we went back, and she was actually on the ground. And she said, "Well, listen, why don't you? I'm just taking a little rest here. Why don't you guys go on without me?" Well, obviously, she was in that mid stage there,
yep.
Where, and you know, she seemed sort of normal, except that it didn't make any sense. But this was just within about 15 or 20 minutes, and she was completely irrational in terms of how she was thinking. You guys go on; I'll catch up with you, which was ridiculous. She was on the ground in the snow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Boy, if that's not a clue, nothing is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked about the Boy Scout that was missing, and they did mention hypothermia. I'm not sure what the weather was back there, but it certainly was cool at night. That's why it's so important to find or improvise some kind of shelter. You want to be out of the wind. If there's any chance of moisture, rain, sleet, a quick hailstorm like we get here in the Rockies, it could only last 10 or 15 minutes, but it could be a real heavy storm that could just drench you. You want to be out of the rain, out of the wind. That means finding a shelter, which could be something as simple maybe as a rock outcrop that's going to protect you from above and from the wind. Or if you can't find something, you're going to have to improvise something, perhaps in the form of a lean-to or something like that.
Now, here's a question. I've run across situations where people have managed to survive. You've done that many more times than I have. But where they're out, for example, in cold weather with a minimum of gear and no real protective clothing, and yet they manage for 2 or 3 days in very cold situations, how are they doing that? What's the best way, if you find yourself in that situation, how can you literally protect yourself against that cold if you're not prepared? Ben, you can't do a fire, you know, but what in your environment have you found or have you heard from people who have managed to survive works?
Well, if you don't have any of those 10 essentials, you're literally unprepared, it's going to be extremely difficult. The two things that you can do, again, are shelter and create heat by exercise. You've got to be able to keep that body warm, and the only way you can do that without anything else is you've got to be able to create that heat internally. That could be as simple as walking uphill. the problem, of course, now is that you're using fuel, which is limited, and at some point in time, you're going to run out of fuel. Now, if the weather is good, it's not windy, which that convection cooling is going to cool you off. It's not wet. That's helpful. You can probably rewarm in the sunshine. That's if it's not a cloudy day like it is here in Denver today.
Let's talk about that night when you got to go those long, 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 endless, cold, miserable, torturous nights that you have to endure. What's the best way to survive those?
Well, you know, I've talked to folks and have heard stories from others that have survived those long, long, cold nights. Every single one of them seems to say the same thing. They just try and catch some sleep, and that they'll get sleep in small chunks. Now, when you get sleep in small chunks, that's what makes that night seem like it's the longest night there ever has been on the planet. Those chunks are probably going to be in, you know, it might be 20 minutes of sleep here, 30 minutes there. And then you're going to wake up, and you're maybe going to shiver. Maybe some exercise is time now for exercise to rewarm yourself and then try and get some sleep some more. And then I think the rest of it is what I would call mental gymnastics, is putting yourself in the right frame of mind and orienting your mindset towards survival, looking ahead to the morning as opposed to concentrating on your situation now or what got you into the situation. Looking forward is probably of a great benefit.
I've spent some of those situations where I've had an absolutely miserable night, and there's nothing like that first crack of dawn.
That's true.
Oh, you feel a new day coming on, and there's hope again.
That's very, very true. Sometimes those great camping trips can be miserable.
Yes, absolutely. Well, listen, and then one last thing. We could go on for, this is great, and I think it's very valuable. But also, the role of the search and rescue dogs. In this particular case, the dog picked up the scent, and it didn't take that dog all that long to find this lost boy in North Carolina. What can you tell us about how to help the search and rescue dogs? Are there ways to help them as well as the teams find you?
There are. The most important thing when it comes to making it easier for a SAR dog, a search dog, to find you is if that dog and that dog's handler, they work together as a team, can have what we call a scent article. You know, a search dog, any dog's ability to smell is in the thousands of times more than us poor little humans. If there is a scent article, something that they can get your specific scent off of, they can then discriminate that scent from that of other people.
It's amazing.
A great scent article is something like a sock that's going to be saturated with scent. Any other piece of clothing is going to work well as well. It doesn't even have to be a piece of clothing. I've seen dogs where the handler has taken them to the missing person's car and scented them, gotten the dog to sniff the car seat, the floor, anywhere where scent will settle. Scent is actually very tiny cells that are constantly falling off your body and leaving this invisible trail behind. So a dog can pick up that scent off clothing, it can pick it up off the car seat, it can pick it up off the ground around the car. For example, at the back of a car where someone might sit on a bumper to put on their boots or to grab their day pack before they head off. So if the dog handler has a scent article, it's going to speed things up. Now, without a scent article, dogs are still useful. They can still find human beings in a given area, but they might find other human beings there as well. So how the dogs are used depends on whether they have a scent article or not, who has been in the area previously, and that sort of thing. Dogs can find scent from a great distance away. It all depends entirely upon the weather in that sense. Which way is the wind blowing? how warm or cool is it? Is it wet or is it dry? I mentioned that the scent the dog is looking for are tiny cells that are constantly falling off of your skin. If the weather is warm and breezy, this isn't too hard to imagine, it's going to dry those cells out, and those cells are going to lose their scent. They're essentially going to die.
Mm-hmm.
If it's cool and slightly damp, that's going to keep the scent in those cells going longer. And if there's a slight breeze to kind of stir them up into the air, that's going to improve that dog's ability to catch that scent even more.
Is there such a thing as leaving scent trails, like rubbing the back of your neck or other places that may be sort of sweaty or whatever else, and rubbing them on rocks or that type of thing? Might that be useful to kind of make these scent trails, if you were thinking, you know, to try to leave your own scent trail, might that be useful, do you think?
You know, it makes sense to me.
And then for those people who have a fire, that really is an advantage, isn't it? Because you can actually, you have heat and other things, but what would be a way to help people locate that fire?
Well, if you're talking about daylight, obviously it's got to be smoke.
Mm-hmm.
At night, the fire itself, of course, and making sure that the fire doesn't get so large that it can get out of hand and start a forest fire. I had a youngster ask me once if we go in and fight forest fires, and I said, no, we're search and rescue.
Mm-hmm.
We go in when people are lost. If there's a forest fire, we run the other way with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But the way to use that fire to attract people during the day is to create smoke. Create smoke by putting wet vegetation on it, letting that thing billow up some smoke. It's going to do one of two things. Someone's going to see it and say, there's smoke over there. We need to go investigate it, see if that might be a clue leading us to our lost person who's standing by the fire. The other thing that could happen is someone's going to see that smoke, and they're going to report it to the authorities, who more than likely are going to call in the fire department to go in and investigate, thinking that we might have a wildfire going. And again, you've got people coming in to help. There's a great chance they're going to find you.
This is such a fascinating topic. And I certainly want to encourage anyone who finds this at all interesting to contact your organization. We're talking with Howard Paul, who is with NASAR.
The National Association for Search and Rescue, and the web address is NASAR.org, NASAR.org.
How long does it take to get certified?
Classes are that are conducted by SAR teams can run anywhere from a few short weeks to many weeks. The NASAR type of curriculum can, again, be a few short weeks or several weeks long. It depends upon the way that the SAR teams use it. My particular SAR team here in Colorado does a training class one night a week for about 8 or 9 weeks, and then follows that up with 3 or 4 full-day sessions out in the field on weekends. So you're talking a total of about one night a week for 12 weeks with 3 or 4 weekend days thrown in there as well. There are other teams that will do it in a more compact manner. There are other teams that will stretch it out over an entire year, sort of on-the-job training.
Well, I can't think of a better way, really. If you like the outdoors, and you have to like the outdoors to be involved in this, rather than just go on hikes, maybe get involved with a SAR team training unit, and benefit yourself and as well those around you. Howard Paul, I want to thank you so much for giving all this terrific information, and I wish you great success in all the future endeavors. Thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure, sir. Thanks very much.
You bet. Thanks for coming along on this week's adventures into the realms of nature and the environment as we journey through the backwoods and the byways to live in harmony with the great gift, this earth, and all the mysteries it provides. Next week, we go deep into the minds of the wild creatures as we look at the emotional lives of animals with Dr. Mark Beckhoff. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet next Thursday or any time on the archives when your Voice of the Earth returns on the Wild Side News.